Okay, welcome back, everybody. It is what, Tuesday, February 1st. Happy 1st of February, 11:10 a.m. And we're here to do Chem 12A. So let me just check in with everybody and see how things are going. How are you guys all doing today? Everything seems to be working all right. No major questions yet, or things are coming up already. I'm working on your first quiz. It's a little bit early. Usually I like to go through a little bit more content before I start throwing quizzes at you, just because what we did was so much review stuff with Lewis structures and formal charge. And that's what I was going to hit, was Lewis structures and formal charge. But even that, trying to give you Lewis structures of an organic molecule and trying to teach you how to do like a backbone and where everything's going, sometimes gets complicated too. And I don't want to overcomplicate it. So usually I wait until we get into a little bit of chapter two here with orbital stuff. So I'll see what's coming at that first quiz here pretty quick. Let's see, everything else seems to be rolling along as expected. We completed chapter one, we're moving into chapter two. I got to warn you, this is one of my favorite chapters. This is one of my favorite subjects to talk about. And I wish I had 3 hours to do this lecture. We'll spread it out. I don't go any faster than you guys will let me go. So I sort of gauge the class and how fast you guys are willing to let me go. And when you tell me that it's going too fast, then I scale it back a little bit. But until then, I try to see how well you guys do with the material. And it really comes down to your questions and things and how well you're understanding. This chapter, however, lays the foundation for a lot of things that we'll do throughout all of Chem 12A. So understanding some of these foundations in atomic orbitals, molecular orbitals, hybrid orbitals, construction of molecules, why things bond, how they bond, what our bonding theories are, all of it plays into not only the three-dimensional structure, but the reactivity of these molecules, why they react the way they do, how electronegativity is related to hybridization, and all of these different things that are really critical core concepts. And this is the first time, too, where we really start to get to talk about structure. And this is a great topic. So I'm watching the chat. I'm not seeing anything come up. I'm going to go ahead and kick it into high gear here and get started. We'll see how this iPad holds out. I think my port on this iPad is starting to wear out a little bit, but if I don't move it too much, get it set in sort of the right spot, maybe we'll go okay. All right. As always, remember, you can stop me at any point to ask questions, to clarify something. I'm going to do this lecture a little bit differently than what I normally do. Normally, what I do is I do this lecture entirely by hand, hand drawing everything. And then after we've hand drawn everything, then I come back and I start to show you some images. But we're recording this, so this is different. So I think that I can integrate three-dimensional images and give you some better conceptions of what these things look at like than I normally do. And we'll see how that goes. Taking notes, I'm taking notes too. These notes get posted, so that'll help a little bit with that. Normally, I do it the other way because when I'm in class, I want you all to be successful at taking notes and learn to take notes from me. And throwing a bunch of three-dimensional images in there into the notes is sometimes not as easy. So I like to teach you how to draw first. Drawing is a big part of it. All right, let's get started. Chapter two, what we need to do is we need to first have an understanding of atomic orbitals and just some reminders about what things are. So we start off by looking at those atomic orbital shapes. And if you guys remember your atomic orbitals, that these are mathematical probability densities. Is really all these are. They're wave functions, and a wave function, definition of a wave function is a probability density model. of where we are likely to see an electron. So let's look at hydrogen. Basically, we base it all off of hydrogen first. And we don't really go in to other elements. Everything is based off the hydrogen model. And so we have a 1s orbital. And a 1s orbital is a spherical orbital. We can think of this as a complete sphere, and that it has no nodes. Another way that we could represent this is to say that we have nuclear distance from the nucleus, and that this is probability of finding an electron, I guess. It's not really energy that's on there, it's really probability. And that when we start off at the nucleus, there's zero probability of finding that electron, and that we go up to some maximum, and then we come out and we never go back to zero. There's always some finite probability of finding an electron infinitely far away from the nucleus. And so there's no nodes in that orbital. When we go to a 2s orbital, 2s orbitals are larger than 1s, also spherical, but the 2s orbital has a node inside it. And so there's another spherical orbital that's inside of this that gets hard to draw. I'm going to leave it sort of as a circle inside a circle. So this has one node. And as we go up in energy, the node looks kind of like this. We have a probability of finding the electron close. And then we have another probability of finding the electron farther away, which is less. And this location here goes back to zero. This is what we call a node. And it is where there is no probability of finding the electron at that node. So oftentimes I don't go back this far, but you know, we liken these three-dimensional standing waves if we go all the way back to Chem-1A, these are likened to one-dimensional standing waves, which oftentimes we symbolize with a rope and two fixed points. And we can show that rope has only one vibrational mode in its ground state. Actually, we'll do it this way. I'll do a dotted line to say this is the possibility that this rope is sort of like swinging and almost like a jump rope, right? And that it has no nodes in it. When I go up in energy, if this is the center line, then what happens is I have a node in energy as I go up in energy, and that rope can now vibrate. One side goes up, the other side goes down. And it swings like that, like a jump rope. And you can envision, and you've seen this, I think, probably, where people can use a jump rope and they can get the rope going up and down in these two different directions if they put enough energy into that rope, spinning it fast enough, and people can jump on one side and on the other side, and you create a node. And so as we go up in energy, 1s has no nodes, 2s has one node, 3s gets even larger, and the 3s has two concentric nodes inside it. And the electron occupies this volume entirely, meaning that one electron will have this shape. It's not like one electron is in one node and another electron is in another node. No, the electron has wave-like properties and occupies this shape and has a probability of being found here and here, but never here. And so it has this wave-like property of occupying this entire volume simultaneously. Principal energy level 3, by the way, would have up, down, up, and come back to the starting point. And that would represent the two nodes that we see. So different ways of representing these. If we go up and we look at 2Ps because principal energy level 2 is the first place that we see P orbitals. P orbitals have a three-dimensional geometry that we fit onto an XYZ axis. And what we see with these is that they occupy a dumbbell shape. You can imagine two balloons hooked butt in together, tied together, and they orient along the axis, the x-axis, the y-axis, and the z-axis. And so we can have 2px, 2py, 2pz. That is because in the 2p orbitals, there are three redundant orbitals. And so this would be 2px, 2py, 2pz, oriented along the axis. And they have a node within the orbital. When you go up to 3p, what happens with 3p is that the orbitals get larger. I'll look at the 3px, but they also get an additional node. So in other words, if I go up to a 3p, the 3p is larger than the 2p, but also there's a concentric node inside it. It is not that the 2p is sitting inside the 3p. That's not what's happening. What's happening is that the 3P is comprised of two concentric, or I should say four concentric lobes, and that there is a node both at the center and an additional node inside the lobe itself. And so every time we go up in principal energy level for an orbital, the orbital gets more complex with more lobes. All right, that's an important component there. Also, that size difference, that as I go up in principal energy level from 1s to 2s to 3s, I am going up in size, in orbital size. I think I have a tool here. It doesn't demonstrate exactly the way that I want. I can't make it go landscape in the way that I want. It will only demonstrate this way. But what I can do is I can go down to a 1s orbital, and that orbital, I can display a bunch of different things for that orbital. Come on back. What I really want is not all of those. I just want that energy function right there. And then I can go up in, this is a 1s, I can go up to a 2s, and you can see the node that gets created in that 2s, I can go up to a 3s, and now I've got two nodes. I can go up to a 4s, and I've got more nodes. And so every time I increase in principal energy level, I go up in the number of concentric rings, concentric nodes, and you can see the probability of finding that electron as distance from the nucleus, even though it's not in landscape mode the way that I want. I can go back, and I can go to 2p, and now I can rotate this p, so that I can kind of get this idea of this dumbbell picture that is here. And in that 2P, what I can do is I can also go up to a 3P. And now you can see really the concentric nodes in the 3P. And so it gives you this idea of what those orbital functions actually look like. All right, that's as much as we need there. Let's go back.
Question here. You're saying that the 3p electrons could be found in the same physical space as the 2p and the 2p electrons?
What I was saying there is that when I look at the 3p orbital, what I'm seeing is not the 2p inside the 3p. This is just the 3p. Now,
I understand that, but the physical spaces overlap.
The physical spaces do overlap, absolutely, but they have different wave functions, and because they have different wave functions, they physically do not overlap, even though their space overlaps.
All righty. So you're not likely to find two electrons in the same physical space anyway. I mean, aside from their charge, within the same, I don't even know what to call it.
So I think I can help you out there. Within an orbital, You can pack two electrons within an orbital, although they must have opposite spins. One must be spin up and one must be spin down. So within any given volume of orbital that I am showing here, it can hold two electrons within that volume, within that space. And those two electrons must be spin opposite. You will never see two electrons with the same spin occupied within the same, because otherwise they would have the same four principal quantum numbers, and that's not allowed within quantum mechanics. They must be uniquely described. They must have four unique quantum numbers for each electron.
Mm-hmm. But since they have different, since the 2p and 3p have different wave functions, it's kind of like you have different two different strings not operate, that are not in tune.
That's right. Okay. Exactly.
All right.
That's a good way to put it.
There's no constructive interference there.
There is no constructive or destructive interference because the wave functions are not, like you said, strings that are in different tunes. Mm-hmm. And they are not interacting in that way. And so, yes, they do not, even though they occupy the same volume, you can think of them almost as being different planes. Planes as in like ethereal planes. One exists without really interrupting or interfering with the other.
All righty.
Okay.
Good enough for now. Question.
Another question. Go for it.
You were showing us the rings. So the area that's light, is that where the electron can be found? In the area that it's more dark, that's where we won't be able to find them?
That is correct. The dark area is considered to be the node, and the light area is greater probability of finding the electron in this scheme, in the way that the scheme is represented. This thing, by the way, can also show phase as color. And so, yes, where the color is where we find the probability of finding the electron. And that color evolves over time so that they actually, the phases evolve over time, and they go from positive to negative. Just like we think of a standing wave, as a standing wave is going from positive to negative as the electron goes up and goes down, or as the string goes up and goes down. These also go up and down in a way, in that their phase, positive and negative, evolve over time. And so what one lobe is positive, that lobe then becomes negative over time as it progresses and goes forward. And so that is a constant phase shift throughout the orbitals.
Ooh. Okay, that makes sense. Thank you.
Yeah, really, really cool stuff when we get into electrons and orbitals. Okay. So from there, what we need to do is we need to talk about the fact that hydrogen orbitals are rough approximations for other nuclei orbitals. They're not perfect. So we say these are rough approximations of the orbitals of other nuclei. They're going to have pretty much the same shape. What am I doing here? Okay. Relative energies and sizes are dependent on nuclear charge and the total number of electrons. On nuclear charge and total number of electrons. Things to remember that remain true as we go through this off-bound principle. Off-bound principle is orbitals fill from bottom, lowest energy to top. So we're going lowest energy to highest energy. The poly exclusion principle. Pauli exclusion principle says that two electrons in the same orbital must have opposite spins. So remember, we represent spin with an arrow. One must be spin up, one must be spin down. And the last one is Hund's rule. And Hund's rule says that electrons will distribute before pairing when orbitals of equal energy are available. So electrons will distribute before pairing. When orbitals of equal energy are available. So in other words, if I'm looking at 2px, 2py, and 2pz, instead of electrons going like this, electrons will spread out. And so there's a pairing energy, there's a cost to pushing electrons together, because even though they're spin opposite, they still repel one another. And that repulsion energy is greater than the energy or it requires energy, and it's less energy to spread them out so that they don't have that repulsion within the same orbital. All right, so those are all the rules that we need to remember. All of those rules hold for molecules as much as they hold for individual atoms and ions when we look at the energy diagrams for individual atoms and ions. When we start to talk about molecules now, we need to talk about what happens in terms of the formation of molecular orbitals. How do molecular orbitals form? How do we make bonds? Okay, so here what we need to do is remember that orbitals are waves, and that waves can come together and can have constructive interference and destructive interference. And so what we need to look at is what happens when two hydrogens come together and make a bond. So what we know is that when we have hydrogens that have a single electron, and that these hydrogens are infinitely far apart, that we can track their energy against their distance. And we can track the entire energy of the system. And what we find is that when those two things are far apart, that their energy starts off relatively high, and that as they come together, their energy starts to come down. And that at some point, their energy comes down and makes a minimum. And then as you start to push them together again, the energy of the system starts to go up. And so what happens here is that those two hydrogens come together and share the electrons in a covalent bond. So we can think about each one of these as individual atoms with their lone single electrons. And at this distance right here, the distance that I see between these two, that is represented here, this is the bonding distance. And what that tells us is that the molecule is more stable sharing the electrons than the two atoms individually not sharing the electrons. And so the energy of the system comes down and energy is released in bond making. This is actually a major misconception among students that in order to make a bond, people think that you need to exert some energy to push these things together to make a bond. The opposite is actually true. Energy is released when a bond is made, that the system becomes more stable as they come closer together. And only when we push them too close, when the electron-electron repulsions and the nuclear-nuclear repulsion start to take over, does the energy of the system start to go up very sharply when we start to push them too close together. So the system becomes more stable. And for hydrogen like this, this is 0.74 angstroms in terms of what that bonding distance is. And we call this a covalent bond. But what is it that is actually happening with those wave functions that allows the energy of the system to come down? That we need to understand constructive and destructive interference and what can happen when we bring two orbitals together. So we need to now look at constructive and destructive interference. If I take an orbital, and this is a hydrogen, and this orbital is a 1s orbital, and it has one electron in it, and let's say that that phase could be either positive or negative. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to construct this out of a positive phase. So we're going to use blue for positive, and we're going to use red for negative. Used to be that when I wasn't teaching this online and we were actually in the classroom, the only way to keep up with me was to have a whole bunch of pens of different colors. And so the favorite tool was the clicky pen that has like, you know, six different colors in the same pen. And the clicking, as soon as I would break out the colors, the clicking in class was insane. And we just all get used to it. But when it first starts, everybody would start laughing because it's just like the clicky pens just start going crazy. And so what we need to do is we need to look at what happens when we bring these things together in phase versus out of phase. So let's first bring two hydrogens together and let's bring them together out of phase. So let's say that the other hydrogen that is here, that is also a 1s, but happens to be negative in phase so that they come together this way. When they overlap, as they come together to overlap, I'm just going to ask my circles to be better. Come on now. When they come together and they overlap like this, one of them is phase positive and one of them is phase negative. And what happens when they come together is they subtract from each other. They destroy each other. It's like two overlapping waves of opposite sign. And these two waves do destructive interference in the area of overlap. So here in the center, we get destructive interference. So here's one hydrogen, here's the other hydrogen. We get destructive interference. And what that leads to is two hydrogens that have a void, essentially, a node in the center of them. And they come together this way. This guy still is positive in phase. The other guy is negative in phase. But the other concept here is that if they come together and they are of like phase, so now I've got a hydrogen, these are each 1s orbitals, each one electron, and they are both of the same phase, now when they come together, they do constructive interference. And it could be that they were both positive, or it could be that they were both negative. They don't have to be only in this one phase. They could be both negative phase. And so in this area here, we get constructive interference. And as these two come together, they build a bonding orbital. And that bonding orbital has sort of a shape, a little bit peanut shaped, mostly spherical. And this is all now positively in phase. And what we give these different names. This is called antibonding. And this one is called bonding. And both happen. Both happen, always. You can't get one without the other. We always get the ability to come together in phase and out of phase. And actually, as they come together in phase and out of phase, what we see is that when two hydrogens come together, the way that we draw these diagrams is to draw the hydrogens with their electrons. And those two hydrogens have a possibility of combining out of phase, producing an orbital here, and in phase, producing a lower energy orbital here. And that out of phase orbital looks much the way that we drew it before with the node and the in phase orbital. And this is called antibonding. And this is called bonding. And what happens is the electrons stack in, and the system decreases in energy because the bonding orbital is lower in energy than the two individual atomic orbitals that gave rise to it. Now, why am I changing my color scheme all of a sudden? I'm changing my color scheme because we follow a color scheme where we do phase, so this is an occupied orbital. And an occupied orbital, phase positive and negative, and an unoccupied orbital. An unoccupied orbital, phase positive and negative. So negative and positive usually follows green and yellow. Yellow is a little hard to visualize, so I like to use sort of a more orange color for it. Occupied is always blue and red. So we have a standard color code of what's happening here. And this is why hydrogen bonds the way it does. And every time I use two atomic orbitals I get two molecular orbitals. The number of orbitals in equals the number of orbitals out. So two atomic orbitals here and here, and I'm getting two molecular orbitals coming out of the system. So the number of orbitals in matches the number of orbitals out. And there are always two orbitals that arise in any bonding, and one of them is antibonding and one of them is bonding. One will be of lower energy and one will be of higher energy. Is this all making sense so far? Or at least jogging some memory of what things look like?
I have one question. You keep talking about them being in phase and out of phase. I'm just a little bit confused on how the hydrogen could be both positive and it could also be negative.
I think because you're assuming positive and negative is charge, and I'm using positive and negative for phase. So when I'm talking about phase, mm-hmm. what I'm talking about is a sine wave moving through space and time. And as that thing moves, this is positive and negative, positive and negative.
Oh,
it is not sense. Charge, it is phase.
Okay, that totally makes a lot of sense.
Okay, so charge, ionic charge is completely different. Ionic charge also has positives and negatives, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the phase of a wave function being positive and negative, which is completely separate from charge. Excellent question. Thank you very much for that.
Okay, that makes sense. Thank you.
Yeah, excellent question. That is perfect. Exactly what I needed. Thank you.
Okay, but then you've got the two hydrogens in the bonding phase or state or whatever, as marked as positive with the blue, but there's no negative in the little drawing there. So
ah, good value.
I was saying that they were both in phase in order to be in the bonding orbital. So where does this negative orbital at the bottom come from?
Remember that when I was showing this over here, that phase is a function of time. And so while I'm showing it as being positive, over time, it would alternate between being completely positive and completely negative.
Okay, so they're both in...
it is one and the same.
Okay, the electrons in the bonding orbital are in the same phase at the same time. I mean, they're both positive at the same time, both negative at the same time.
Well, to be clear, it's not both, because now they don't exist as individuals. They are now a molecule, and this orbital is a single orbital, and this orbital will alternate through positive and negative phase over time.
I got it now. Thank you.
You're welcome. And the same thing is going on up here, that while the left-hand side is positive currently and the right is negative, those lobes would alternate over time. But they would always be opposite in phase for each of those lobes. Okay. So this begs the question then, if every time I bring two electrons together like this, I get a bonding orbital, why are some elements diatomic and some elements monatomic? Why aren't they all diatomic? Let's take helium and look at helium for a minute and do this same picture with helium. So what I can do with helium is I can ask the question, how come helium, actually, I don't want to put it on the line, I want to put helium off to the line. Why is helium not diatomic? Like hydrogen. So what we find is that hydrogen is H2, but helium is H1. HE1, and it doesn't have two. It doesn't make a bond like this. So why can't helium be diatomic? And the answer to that question is in the fact that helium has two electrons. And so when helium comes together with these two orbitals, they're both 1s orbitals. So this is a 1s and this is a 1s. They're coming together and doing exactly the same thing that hydrogen is doing. And so here is the helium now where they are close together and the bonding orbital. And here is helium with the antibonding orbital, where one is thrown out that lobe and one is thrown out that lobe. And the difference is the number of electrons. Look at what happens. I get two electrons in the bonding and I get two electrons in the antibonding. There is no net energy gain. There is no net stabilization. That helium as an individual atom has the exact same energy as helium coming together to bind, except now I have the electron-electron repulsions and the nuclear-nuclear repulsions that actually push the two apart. And there is no net energy stabilization gain in coming together to try to share the electrons. So no net stabilization gain. Because antibonding is full as well. And a part of this is that antibonding, full antibonding orbitals disrupt bonding. Or another way to say this, I'm going to say it a different way. Electron density in an antibonding orbital. That's a better way to say it. Electron density in an antibonding orbital disrupts bonding. Is a good way to say that. And so these orbitals, I'll just go ahead and do these all. Negative phase here. And this one is occupied now rather than unoccupied. So we'll keep the color scheme going. All right. And so anytime you dump electron density into an antibonding orbital, you disrupt the bonding orbital and you disrupt the actual bonding. Okay. Moving forward with this, one of the things that we could do too is we could talk about, I don't know how far I need to go with this. Maybe this is a good idea here too. Let's look at HCl and what we can do with HCl. When we look at the valence electrons for hydrogen, hydrogen brings in the 1s electron. But chlorine is a much different beast. Chlorine's last electrons are in a 3p orbital. And so when I look at chlorine, chlorine is using the electrons that are in the 3p's. And so everything down below 3p is occupied with chlorine, but that means that these orbitals have very different shapes to them. So let's say that this is the 2px, just to make it easy for us to 3px, to make it easy for us to deal with geometry and how we're going to align things. And that the geometry of that orbital is such that it is a p orbital. And I'm bringing that together with a smaller spherical orbital. And so these orbitals are going to come together. And of course, the 3p orbitals are much higher in energy than the 1s orbitals. They are not equivalent in terms of the amount of energy that each one of those brings together. And so what happens here is that when they come together in phase and out of phase. Another way to represent that is to say, all right, I'm going to take my 1s orbital and I'm going to overlap it with my 3P. And I'm going to do that in phase. So I'm going to take and say that this guy is in phase. There's my other lobe that's there. I'm going to move this down so I have space to put my line, because that's going to represent my line that's here. And this orbital, what this orbital is going to look like is that it is going to be a bonding orbital. I'll get to that image in a minute. I need to think about that a little bit more. Let's do the antibonding one though. That one is going to be higher in energy. And up here, what's happening is that the hydrogen is coming in one phase. And the chlorine is in the other phase. And so what happens is this becomes the bonding orbital where the two electrons combine. And we're really talking about here that 3px that's coming down and binding to it. And the other one is empty up at the top. And this becomes the bonding orbital. And this is the hydrogen and the chlorine. And this orbital has something that looks a bit like this in its shape. As they overlap and they make the bonding orbital, that is the bond part. And this is a smaller orbital on the back. This guy, when they combine, maybe I didn't need to make it quite so tall. When they combine to make a small lobe out on this side, the hydrogen, a lobe that extends sort of in the middle, and a lobe that extends out over here. And this is the chlorine, where the chlorine sits. And this really does take on three different lobes. Oh, and they should be empty. So I'm going to do green and green and the orange color. And this is what we call antibonding. And this is what we call bonding. And so the chlorine and the hydrogen can come together and can do this bond. And the same thing happens even if the orbitals are more complicated, an S to a P as opposed to S to S, right? And so it is not the shape of the orbital so much as the phase of the overlap that allows us to be able to make a bond. And the concept and idea that when we make a bond, that what we're doing is we're bringing in two electrons together, and hopefully we're not taking more electrons and stacking more electrons into the antibonding. Otherwise, the molecule tends to fall apart if electrons get put into the antibonding orbital. Okay. And this one's in phase. All right. Now, the question then, Clarissa, I'm looking back, seasonal change that you mentioned for the two molecular orbitals. I might have missed the question. That was back at 11:50. That was 10 minutes ago. I don't know if I answered it. Hit me up again if I missed it. All right. So the question now becomes, how do we get something that is tetrahedral? How do we get all the VSEPR geometries? Specifically, tetrahedral. So in other words, when we look at carbon and we look at a molecule like CH4, CH4, we know the Lewis structure for this. We should be able to do this Lewis structure pretty easily. And we know that this is what we call an AX4, and then an AX4 is tetrahedral. And that tetrahedral is bond angles of 109.5 degrees. And so every angle here would be 109.5 degrees. And the question is, how do we get 109.5 degrees out of this as a bonding model when we know what carbon's electrons look like, right? So hydrogen comes in with the 1s, and we know what that thing looks like. That thing is spherical. But carbon starts off with the 1s. Let's do it this way. Here's carbon's 1s. Here's carbon's 2s. And then we've got 2p. And carbon has the four valence electrons. And so that these guys here are the valence electrons. And this is carbon. And that these have different geometries, right? And so I can look at sort of an XYZ model here that the S is spherical. But then when I look at these guys, I've got 2px and 2py that I have an orbital that extends out that way, an orbital that extends out forwards and backwards, and I have one more that extends in the Z orbital axis, and that those things are all 90 degrees to each other. And that these guys make bond angles, these are all 90 degrees to each other. So where in all of this does 109.5 come from? That's what the major question is. And that's what we need to resolve. Okay, so in order to resolve this, a theory was proposed. Pauling was one of the main individuals. I'm trying to think of the other individuals and their names. And the names are going to escape me. But Pauling was a major proponent of the idea here that these geometries of the atomic orbitals must in some way reorganize when bonding occurs, and that we need some model theory as to how to reorganize these to come up with appropriate sorts of bond angles. And so the model theory that we're going to look at is a combination of theories. There are multiple theories that we can put into it. One of them was called natural bonding theory, and the other one was called molecular orbital theory. They're equivalent theories, but they do slightly different things. What we're going to do is we're mainly going to stick with natural bonding theory, but I need to talk about both so that we sort of understand the differences here. So bonding theories or models. One of them is molecular orbital theory. In molecular orbital theory, orbitals are delocalized over the entire molecule. Each molecular orbital may contribute bonding interactions to more than one hydrogen or one carbon. see, may contribute bonding interactions. That's what I want to say. To more than just two atoms. In other words, a molecular orbital can contribute to bonding of three atoms or four atoms or five atoms, and that it can contribute bonding interactions, positive glue that holds these together, and that it does so for more than just two atoms. Molecular orbitals are a linear combination of atomic orbitals. I'm going to say built with linear combinations of atomic orbitals. In other words, what they do is they take the atomic orbitals and they add them together as wave functions, putting different weights on each of the atomic orbitals to combine to build a molecular orbital. So molecular orbitals are built of atomic orbitals. Molecular orbitals are wave equations which minimize nuclear-nuclear repulsions, electron-electron repulsions, along with other factors. They're wave equations just like atomic orbitals are. So they're wave equations which minimize nuclear-nuclear repulsions. Electron-electron repulsions. And other factors. Natural bonding theory is a little bit different. Oh, let me add one more thing in here before I go to natural bonding theory. Molecular orbital theory is very good at predicting energy levels and spectroscopy. So when I say spectroscopy, I mean that when we shine light on a molecule and the molecule absorbs light and the electrons go to a higher energy wavelength and then fall back down and release light, and we can see what the differences in the energy levels are within that molecule, molecular orbital theory is spectacularly accurate at predicting those energy levels and the energy levels within the molecule. It's very good at that. And so in that, you would say that this is a very successful model and must be true. And it is to a degree, but there's not more than one way to look at things. And that's where we get to natural bonding theory and natural bonding orbitals. So natural bonding theory and natural bonding orbitals are different. Is there a question to check in?
I was just wondering if I could see that last part you wrote down real quick.
Oh, yeah, right there. Are we good? As I joke over here.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Cool. All right, natural bonding theory. Natural bonding orbitals are built first by combining natural atomic orbitals into natural hybridized orbitals. So this is where we do a stepwise approach. Stepwise approach where Atomic orbitals are used to build hybrid orbitals. The hybrid orbitals are mathematical combinations of the atomic orbitals. So what we say here is that linear combinations of atomic orbitals are used to build hybrids. All right. These hybrid orbitals then have better orbital overlap when used in bonding, is the idea here. The hybrid orbitals have better geometry and overlap for bonding. Let's call it making bonding orbitals.
So does this conflict with the molecular orbital theory or sit on top of it?
It does not sit on top, nor does it conflict. It is just different, although it results in the same structure. Both theories, when applied to a molecule in bonding, will arrive at the exact same structure. But the natural bonding theory is used in a different way, in that here what we're doing is we're taking all of the atomic orbitals and combining them straight to make molecular orbitals. This is an extremely computationally intensive practice, can only be done by supercomputers and cannot be easily visualized. Natural bonding theory can be reduced to a practice that can be done more instead of quantitatively, or instead of qualitative, instead of quantitatively can be done more qualitatively, and can allow us to be able to use this as a model to be able to do these types of bonding interactions, drawing them on a piece of paper. Without hard calculation. However, when applied to hard calculation, they arrive at the exact same predictions as what molecular orbital theory does. So what happens here is that we take, for instance, tetrahedral carbon, carbon that is got the valence electrons of the 2s and the 2p. So we're looking at carbon, which is 1s2, 2s2, 2p2, we take these valence electrons and these atomic orbitals. We work with just the valence. So we combine the 2s and we combine the 2px, the 2py, and the 2pz. So 2px will say here goes in the x direction. This one will come out towards us and go back away from us. That's the y direction and the z direction. And we combine these in a linear combination, adding them together as their wave functions. And as we add those together, what we get is we get something that is 1/4 s plus 3/4 p. And so what we get is we get something that is sp3. And that sp3 in its shape is more p character, right? It has 3/4 p character and only 1/4 s character. And so what it looks like is it looks like an orbital that has a large front side and a smaller backside. Not equal lobes. This is what we call an SP3. And it has two phases. One phase is positive and one phase is negative. It has a node in its center. And how many atomic orbitals did we combine in order to make this?
Four.
We combine four. So how many of these hybrid orbitals should we make?
Four.
Exactly. When you combine four atomic orbitals, you have to get the same number of orbitals out as you put in. So four atomic orbitals out means that I get four of these SP3 hybrid orbitals that come out. And now when I take those four hybrid orbitals, combine to give me four orbitals around a central atom, each repelling each other because of the negative charge in each of the orbitals, will seek to orient themselves in a natural tetrahedron geometry. And so what winds up happening now is if I take a look at an XYZ axis and putting in these four orbitals, I get an orbital that will start off by going with one orbital up. And then the other orbitals are going to combine themselves into a natural tetrahedron geometry. This one goes back and has the little lobe that's over there. And the bond angles here now are of 109.5 degrees. And each one of these are four SP3 orbitals in a tetrahedral. These now are carbon's orbitals that carbon can use to make bonds. And so carbon will now make bonds using these hybrid orbitals to combine with other elements in order to make bonding orbitals. So what happens now? What we do is we take hydrogen. Let's reconstruct this last picture. And I'll just take a little bit more care in how I construct it. I'm going to take this orbital here, and I'm going to combine it with a hydrogen. So this is the hydrogen's orbital. This is where carbon would be sitting in the center of this. And then each of these additional orbitals are going to come and combine with another hydrogen orbital in order to make the tetrahedral geometry. And I'm going to put my last one back sort of in this direction. And so these four are combining in order to come together to make a carbon which has 109.5 degree bond angles. Now, when these come together, what we need to do is we need to bring in those two orbitals, the hybrid orbital from the carbon and the atomic orbital from the hydrogen, and they need to combine. And so I just want to show what that looks like really quick. So hydrogen, we're bringing in this spherical. Carbon, we're bringing in an orbital that has one electron in it, but this is now an SP3 hybrid. And this is the 1s atomic. And they are combining to make a bonding interaction. and we can look at what that bonding interaction looks like. So when in phase, what that bonding interaction is going to look like is it's going to look like a hydrogen bound to a carbon where these guys are all encompassed in an orbital and there's a little tiny back lobe on it. And this is all one phase in the big orbital. And the small back lobe has a little tiny counterphase. And when they come together and they make an antibonding orbital, what happens is the hydrogen's electron density gets thrown out that way. The carbon's electron density gets thrown out this way. I think there's another little back lobe that's on this thing. And we wind up getting three lobes. Oops, wrong color. These are empty. We'll show what these images actually look like. We'll amend these images a little bit. And they come together in a bonding interaction. And this is what is called bonding, but we give it a specific name. We call it a sigma bond. And this symbol, which looks like an O with a little top knot on it, this is called sigma. And this is a sigma bond. And this one gets that same sigma symbol, but it gets a little star on it. And it's pronounced sigma star. The sigma star is the antibonding. And the sigma is the bonding orbital. And it winds up making four of those orbitals, bonding orbitals, in order to bring the whole thing together. So now the big question is, why do we have two models? What's this whole idea of why do we have molecular orbital theory and why do we have natural bonding theory? Why do we have the two different theories and where are we going to spend most of our time? So let's finish this out. Why two models? And then I'll show you some images. Molecular orbital theory. We have two different theories because the two different theories do two different jobs. They're very useful. Both are useful. Both are useful for different things. Molecular orbital theory. Usually we just refer to it as molecular orbital theory, MO. Molecular orbital theory is useful for predicting spectroscopy. It is really good for certain types of molecules, aromaticity. It explains aromaticity really well. Certain types of cycloadditions. Can only be handled by molecular orbital theory. Calculating molecular energies, heats of formation. So those are all sort of under the domain of molecular orbital theory. That's where molecular orbital theory really shines. What about this natural bonding theory? Natural bonding theory gives information regarding molecular shape. That's not to say that molecular orbital theory isn't good for shape. Molecular orbital theory also does shape. But it can't be done in your head. Natural bonding theory gives shape, and it can be done in your head without going through a full-blown calculation. It's an extension. I shouldn't say it's an extension of VSEPR theory. I should say that VSEPR theory is an extension of natural bonding theory. So it's sort of like the other way around. Really good for bond angles. Really good for bond angles, lengths. Really good for acid base in predicting the strength of acid base, predicting stability of molecules. Relative stability or reactivity of molecules, all of those things come out of natural bonding theory. So what winds up happening is we'll use both. And sometimes I'll go back and forth between them and not even really tell you which one I'm dealing with. But most of the time, when we're looking at localized bonding, we're looking at hybridization. All of those things, we're dealing with natural bonding theory. If I'm looking at predicting spectroscopy, aromaticity, cycloadditions, I start to take it to molecular orbital theory. I start to look at overall orbitals over an entire molecule. Then I'm starting to deal with molecular orbital theory. But most of the time, I'm here. Most of the time, I'm in natural bonding theory. That's where we're kind of working in that wheelhouse. So let me just show you a couple images real quick, because I know I'm short on time and I want to get some of these images in. We're going to do a lot more with images. We're going to start to talk about where all of these geometries come from, how we can make different geometries, talking a lot about hybridization, how hybridization affects bond length, how it affects polarity, how it affects electronegativity, how it does all of these things. All right, so what I want to show you here is methane. I can show you some of the other things that we were talking about with hydrogen and helium too, but let's start with methane real quick. Tetrahedral in nature. Everybody seeing what I got on the screen? I can't see you guys, so I'm going to assume I've got a green box. I'm green lighted. I'm assuming you're seeing the model that's here. This model gives me molecular orbitals, natural atomic orbitals, natural hybrid orbitals, and finally the natural bonding orbitals. So molecular orbital theory, when you ask for molecular orbitals, you just get those molecular orbitals. You can see that the zeros that are here, the zero tells me that's unoccupied. The two tells me that that's occupied. The energies of each one of these orbitals is represented here. Notice that when I go from bonding, occupied, they are negative, and I transition to zero, unoccupied, they go to positive energy. Okay, so that's one thing to note. Also note that there are way more orbitals than are being shown in this little tiny screen here, that 23 atomic orbitals came together to make these molecular orbitals. There are 23 molecular orbitals that come into play. I could ask it to show me all 23 and I could see the occupied ones and all of the unoccupied ones. Then when I go to the natural atomic orbitals, there are 23 atomic orbitals. There are 23 natural hybrid orbitals and there are 23 natural bonding orbitals. So let me show you the molecular orbital really quick, just to say, hey, look, these go over the entire molecule. Here is the highest occupied molecular orbital. It fits over multiple atoms and doesn't seem to show any bonding in particular. It is an orbital that is not just, this is one orbital and the two lobes of that one orbital, positive phase and negative phase of those two lobes. So you can think of it as a node in between. And this is a bonding interaction, which is helping to glue the carbon simultaneously to all four electrons. Okay, I can look at the antibonding orbital, the first one that is unoccupied. Notice the color change. And notice how pretty that it's not these simple pictures. For molecular orbital theory does not give nice, beautiful, simple pictures. This is an antibonding. Notice that there is no density between the carbon. Well, that's the carbon. No density between the carbon and the hydrogen. And that's because this is an orbital that is unoccupied and is not helping to glue the molecule together. It is just a result of things coming together out of phase. Right? That's molecular orbital theory. Complicated, hard to envision, hard to understand, but really good at spectroscopy and all kinds of other things. Now we go to those atomic orbitals. All right, so I'm going to ask for all 23. And in these atomic orbitals, I could ask for the carbons S. I could ask, here's a carbon 2S. Here's a carbon 3S. The carbon 2S is occupied, so I could ask it to show me the carbon 2S. As predicted, that should be spherical. This is just the carbon's orbitals. I could ask it to show me the carbon's 2P's. So I'm looking in here in atomic orbital, and I need carbon 2P. Here is a carbon 2P. Should be a nice P orbital centered on the carbon, and that's what it is. Absolutely symmetric. That's the atomic carbon 2P. When I combine the S with the 2P, I get into a hybrid orbital. So now I'm going to look at the hybrid orbital. I want 1/4 S and 3/4 P. This is an SP3 hybrid orbital. If I ask for that one, it should have one lobe large and one lobe smaller. There is the SP3 hybrid. Notice that the SP3 hybrid is pointed in the direction of one of the hydrogens. So that is the SP3 hybrid that is going to be used to make the bond with that hydrogen, hydrogen number 3 specifically. There would be 3 more of these SP3 hybrids that are going to be used to make the bond. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you the bonding orbital, the localized natural bonding orbital. All right, here it comes. I want the carbon to hydrogen 3. This is a bonding orbital. That is the sigma bond. Notice that it goes over the hydrogen. So there's the sigma bond going over the hydrogen, and that's its small back lobe. I can also ask it to show me the antibonding. So the corresponding antibonding with carbon 1 and hydrogen 3. The localized antibonding, carbon 1 and hydrogen 3 antibonding, this one. There's the antibonding orbital with hydrogen 3, and you can see that there's no electron density. Right there, there's a node between the two atoms, no glue holding the two atoms together. And I have the 3 different lobes in alternating positive, negative, and positive. And that's what that antibonding orbital looks like that I was trying to draw on my page. So these orbitals in natural bonding theory are much easier to like build just by thinking about them and the geometry and overlap of the orbitals. And while we can submit it to calculation on the supercomputer and we can get all the same results in geometry and everything that we would have gotten with molecular orbital theory, natural bonding theory has an extension to it, sort of like this easy way of doing it qualitatively by doing it on the piece of paper and drawing it out. And it is a very, very useful model for understanding geometry and bonding in organic molecules. And that's what we're going to spend a bit of time doing to develop all the different geometries. So we can develop tetrahedral, trigonal planar, linear. We can develop all of these different geometries that we see with carbon using natural bonding theory and hybridizations. And that is where I'll end it. Let me stop this share. That's a lot of stuff that I just threw at you. Like I said, it's one of my favorite lectures. We're going to come back. We're going to do more of this when we come back on Thursday. We'll put more images together. We'll look and develop all these different geometries. And from that, we'll start to build this idea of organic chemistry and reactivity and where that reactivity comes from using natural bonding theory. as a an underlying model to understand all of these other aspects of reactivity and structure. But this is where it starts. This is all the fun stuff. All right.
And one more thing, were we getting a quiz today? It was on the schedule.
Yeah, like I said, those quizzes are open for several days. So yes, I'm gonna try to get it up online and then you'll have a couple of days to complete it. So not that it needs to be done immediately. And if I don't get it up today, it should be up today, but if I don't, it'll be up tomorrow and that'll be okay too. We will live.
All righty, good enough, thank you.
Okay, take care you guys. And I'll see you either for office hours or lab tomorrow morning, or I'll see you back on Thursday. Do you